Hey everybody, I'm Chris.
I'm Steven.
We like board games.
And beer.
We decided to pair them. We think you should too. Welcome to
Table Hops.
I've been replaced by another Steven.
Well, I mean, as you should be, really.
You would get a lot more done if it was just two of you and not me.
Ain't that
but welcome everybody. Thanks for checking us out. We are here today with three very special guests, the creators, the creative team behind The Night Cage, that has just completed a successful Kickstarter campaign. Congratulations!
Hi, that's us. We're the creators of The Night Cage.
Do you guys want to introduce yourselves?
Couldn't hurt.
Let's do it alphabetical order.
All right. Well, in that case, hi, I'm Chris Chan, the first Chris.
I guess that makes me the second Chris. I'm Chris McMahon. I'm also one of the designers for The Night Cage.
Hi, I'm Ryan.
I had the most beard of, I think, actually anyone here. I'm going to challenge you on this one, Stephen.
Oh, yeah, for sure. There is no challenge needed.
If you need backgrounds, there you go.
Yeah. You got it.
Very respectable, though. Very, very respectable beard. Let's make sure that's
very
clear.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ross Saunders. I'm also a designer of The Night Cage. I'm the least Chris.
You are the least Chris, but you're the second most beard, I feel, out of this group.
That's probably
that
true.
I mean, I guess that's...
I think that's true, yes.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that's true.
Yeah. You've seen me attempting to grow a beard, Ross. It's bad.
I've seen your mustache. You could grow an impressive mustache.
It probably looks like Chris's peas beard.
I can do that, but it doesn't grow anymore.
Yeah, I've got that problem, too. It's terrible.
Yeah?
Yeah, it makes me crazy.
I just got to do a Chris P here, dude. He leaned into it. He's like, it's fine.
Oh, no, you should have seen him like 3 weeks ago. It was bad. It was real bad.
Yeah. I always look like I'm about to hold up a train or wipe out a glass with a rag. And that's my only lot in life now.
Right. Sell a horse for a single coin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. So you guys introduced yourself, but you didn't introduce what you're drinking. And that's a big part of Table Hops.
That's very rude of me.
I'm sorry.
I have a drink. I'm drinking things. Not going over to the fridge right now to get something.
Definitely not going to the fridge.
Everyone listening to this later will completely believe you. We are seeing the lie happen before.
I feel a little guilty because when I lived in New York with these two fine gentlemen, it was really easy to get excellent beer everywhere. But Chicago hasn't quite figured that out, so there's no gap between like grocery stores that just have what everyone has, and then like really specialty stores that have like really cool stuff, but you can only buy like one of them at a time, and it's like $35, and like you want it, but you can't just like have it all the time around.
So
I am right now. I'm enjoying still very good Leinenkugel's summer shandy, but a very good summer beer for August. So I'm very happy about that.
You always know what you're getting with the summer shandy. Like
it's really solid.
Ross, you're drinking something special, right?
Yeah, I got the Dogfish Head Worldwide Stout.
Mm. We're jealous.
It's good. Yum, it's yum, sweeter yum. Than I expected, actually, which is not a bad thing. It's kind of a dessert kind of situation, which is nice.
Interesting. I'm looking at the description for this beer, and it says it originated in the winter of 1999, and they suggest that it tastes like hope.
It's got the optimism of the 90s infused into it.
The economy's going to grow forever.
I better drink this beer before it figures things out.
Oddly enough, they suggest that you pair it with falafel.
That's very specific.
Are you craving?
I can see that because it has like, well, because I said it's very sweet. So I think you could get that kind of salty, savory thing with the falafel. And I actually think it would go pretty well together. So that probably would not have been my first guess at their pairing.
Right.
Sweet isn't normally something that you put on a 15% beer, but.
True.
That could be dangerous.
You're gonna get a stout though. Like that's
a headache waiting to happen.
Course, yeah.
Guys, I'm really appreciating the pep talk about the beer here.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Also, in case you're not into the falafel, Dogfish Head also suggests either a bacon chocolate cheesecake or five onion soup.
Did they just open up like a dispensary in like Colorado or something? Like where are these recommendations?
Yeah, I'm trying to make, like, you know what I need to have? What I would have
dispensary.
I got three
just
things.
Just walk on over to your second kitchen and ask your personal chef to whip up falafel, nice bacon chocolate cheesecake, or falafel
500 super whatever. Like, Ross, I think you have to start making all those things now while you're on the phone with us, and then let us know which one goes best with the beer.
Yeah, without a doubt.
I think if you go to Dogfish Head, you need to go up and order that stuff and be like, I'll take the three courses to go with that, please.
Chris P., can you name five onions?
Can I name five onions?
Yes, five different types of onions.
I can. Here we go. There's the white onion. There's the yellow onion. Red onion. Pearl onions and shallots. Does shallots count?
I'll have you with green. Vidalias.
Chris, you gave him away the fifth one right there.
Yep.
You said every color except for green. Why is you
they don't look, they're not onion shaped. They're stocky.
Okay, that's fair.
I mean, they are the same sort of layered spicy plant, though. You know, if you bite into it like a shallot or a green onion, you'll regret it about as much as if you bite into a white onion, you know, raw.
That's fair.
I feel like I came from a place of experience.
I have never dipped green onions in hummus frequently. I've never done that. I don't know what you're talking about.
Today. It didn't happen today.
No, it didn't happen today, unfortunately. But, oh, man. It's a terrible combination. No one should do it.
All right. Well, thanks very much, guys, for coming. We just wanted to name all those onions. We hope you've enjoyed yourself.
This is the onion.
Yeah, thanks for having us on the show, guys. We'll see you later.
Name an hour? Yeah.
Chris Chan, what did you end up grabbing from the mysterious fridge?
Well, okay. So it's not a beer. It's a hard cider.
That's fine. That's totally fine.
That counts. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you had like a wine spritzer or something like that.
No. Honestly, it's pretty close to one. It's like a Hazlitt's like hard cider. So, you know.
I think
Jen bought it, so, you know.
It's a step above Angry Orchard, so you're in the green for me. Wait, are you also a Canadian, Chris?
No. I just live with one.
I think I'm the only Canadian in this current chat, but I'm the third Chris. So.
You are the third Chris. You're the worst Chris.
The lowest. One day I hope to level up, but not this day.
So kind of associated with what we were just talking about, we are all beer. Well, not all of us, but some of us are beer fanatics. Just want to figure out, what is your guys' go-to beer?
I mean, it just depends. I kind of rotated the summer shandy because one of my staples is Oberon. I'm from Michigan, so I have a deep Michigan taste in beer. Oberon's great, but you know, if you spend all summer just drinking the same like three or four beers, eventually you got to keep it circling through stuff. Unless you want to go farther afield to find some exotic things. Oberon's a great staple. I'll go with, I feel like I don't have like a lot of go-tos. I'm usually a person who, like, when I have a chance to buy something that I haven't seen before, I try and do that whenever I can. Especially when it comes to, like, you know, I'm really a bit like, one of you has a barley wine that I'm very jealous of. But like, there's no like, my go-to is a barley wine. Like, that's not a reasonable way to approach that. I feel like I just every day just pounding barley wine. So
I
try and find stuff when it's available or what's interesting to see. I think Founders is usually a really good starting point for me for a lot of stuff. New York, I was really impressed how accessible, like, you know, like Breakfast Out and like even like KBS and CBS became. In the last couple of years, that's been a really great one for like when it gets into autumn and winter. But like, you don't want to have KBS when it's like 90 degrees out, you know, like sitting on the porch. Like that's not the right vibe for that.
So funny enough, we were just talking about this in our area. We have a lot of breweries and they're releasing a bunch of stouts. It's like the summer of stouts. And we think it's partially because they can't keep. And in this current situation, they've had to dump a lot of beer, but the stouts survived. So I'm like, oh man, it's 100 degrees outside. I think I'll take a double stout. It sounds perfect.
Oddly, a lot of peanut butter stouts.
It cools you off like having to chew your beer.
Peanut butter's been making like a comeback now. Like,
look, the beer, I'm all about that.
Also, like, I saw in the store I saw five peanut butter whiskeys the other day, and it's like, how is this the trend? How is peanut butter the trend this year for alcohol?
I mean, I'd rather peanut butter in my booze than coffee. Like, you know, I like to keep my drugs separate.
You're up just counters separate. Yeah.
I feel that.
It's been a huge thing. You're right. It's like constantly in a Reese's cup. If it wasn't for a pandemic, I'd be surprised, but there's nothing else that surprises me anymore.
Yep. Well, it's what you have in your fallout shelter. So
forever free.
Ross, are you speaking from experience?
I gotta make a new whiskey here. What I got in the panic room?
I've got garbanzo beans, peanut butter, and Vidalia onions. Just endless Vidalia onions, huh?
They also keep really well in the cellar.
I feel like Rob's going to take it off the background and just move it out of the way, and you're going to see all those ingredients start.
A wall of onions.
Oh, I can't show you. That's the wine we're making, though, over there.
That is very cool.
Oh, cool.
Oh.
Yeah.
How'd you get into winemaking?
Yeah. I was married to a person who decided to make wine.
All right.
His side of the story is very short.
When I say the wine we're making, I mean the wine I'm watching other people make.
That's fair. That's fair.
So you'll drink it. You get the best.
Oh, yeah. No. I'm definitely.
So are you more of a wine or a beer person?
I'm more of a beer person. So okay. It works out.
All right. Like, what's your go-to beer?
I'm not a major threat to the wine that's being made. I mean, like my go-to, like I have like really poor impulse control, so I like a nice all-day IPA. It's nice.
It's another Founders. That's a good
one. Yeah, it is. Founders is great. I like Founders a lot.
Michigan.
Yeah. I also like a lot of 6-point, like a sweet action. It's good to sit around and just sort of sip on and feel nice and relaxed. So,
speaking of which, I had from 6-point, I had their high res, their triple IPA, It's my new like 5-star beer right now. I like did a backflip when I didn't. I'm very unathletic, but it was very tasty.
Yeah. They're good. They're really good.
And it's like 11% too, and it doesn't taste like it at all. It's insane.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you can't even feel yourself going blind. It's great.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
It's very gradual.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh man.
Chris Chan, go-to beer or alcoholic beverage. No judgments.
No. When we're talking about beer, I like a Hefeweizen. Like, just my general category of beer that I will basically never say no to. I don't really have a particular brand that, like, I go to. I like to, when I go out and I see them, I, like, you know, go, okay, well, what's the Hefe that I can go try today? So that's kind of, like, what I do. I mean, obviously other things are great, but you know, that's my go-to.
Hefeweizens are really good. And at least in our area, we don't get enough of those and we don't get enough Belgians. Cause I like Belgians a lot.
Agreed.
Like Belgian. Go and like, hey, you guys want one of our 30 juicy IPAs? Cause we have that.
Yeah. I mean, your best bet for a Hefe around here is just Polliners, right? Or like, what's the other one? Schafferhofer.
Weinhen Stefanter. I don't think I'm pronouncing it anymore, but that one is like the like pinnacle of Hefeweizen's in my opinion.
Right, but like at a bar, like you find Polliners everywhere.
There's Blue Moon. That's adjacent to a Hefeweizen. You know?
Wheat beer, sure.
Yeah, it's wheat.
Hogarth. Hogarth. That's the easy to find.
Oh, there you go. Hogarth. Yeah. I lived in Atlanta. There's a bar called the Brick Store, and they have a regular bar on the first floor. And if you go upstairs, they have a Belgian bar, and all they have is Belgians on tap at the second bar.
Wow.
So when the world reopens again, make a trip to Atlanta, check it out. It might be worth a trip by itself.
Absolutely. That's insane.
A whole floor of Belgians?
Yeah, it's the Brick Store. And there's also, what's the place in the little 5 points? There's another place. It just has like an entire cellar of like they have like thousands of beers in the cellar. They sell by the bottle stuff they're keeping on age. They have like a little Bible, a couple like dozens of pages, and it's just full of stuff that they have in the basement.
Wow,
that's awesome. See you link later.
That sounds so cool. See, we need. I want to go out and do things again, guys.
Me too.
Yeah.
At least it's board games, right?
Yeah. So speaking of board games.
Yeah. Look at that segue. It's like you've done amazing. This before.
So you guys are obviously designed Night Cage, recently raised $220,000, I believe, right?
Yes.
On Kickstarter, ended just a couple days ago, actually. Mm-hmm. And tell us about Night Cage. Tell us about your lovely new game.
Who wants to go?
Is lovely the right word, guys?
No,
it's so lovely.
All right.
I'll lovely might not be right.
Okay. Right. All right. Top line. The Night Cage is a cooperative tile placement game with an existential horror theme set in an otherworldly labyrinth of eternal darkness. That's the thing that the Kickstarter page says.
The elevator pitch right there.
I know. Right?
Checked.
So, like, the idea of the Night Cage is that you and the other folks around the table are these prisoners, right? You're these nameless, faceless people, and you've just woke up in this deep, dark maze. And all you've got is this candle, right? Each of you just has a single candle, nothing else, and it's burning out really quick. So if you want to get out of the maze, you've got to explore it so that you can find these keys, and then you've all got to bring these keys to a gate together, and once you do that, you'll be able to collectively escape. But the thing that makes the maze weird and a little bit unsettling, aside from the monsters in it, is that what you see with like the dim light of your candle exists. And what you don't see anymore ceases to exist and is swallowed by the darkness forever. So the game is about making and unmaking the maze with your observation of it. So it's, to be high-minded, a game that is kind of rooted in solipsism. but more importantly, is about being trying to get out of the dark without quite enough time.
Yeah, so Chris, you actually were the one that found out about this project, right?
Yeah, I played, I think, Chris Chan, I think it was you that actually might have demoed it for me. If you were at PAX, not the last PAX, but a year before, I played it in the what's that room called with the prototypes? Like just the
Unpub room.
Unpub.
Yeah, the Unpub room. Yeah,
Unpub Valley.
And I remember playing it, and you guys had like instead of the you had keys, but they were like from Michael's, like the little like pendant style keys or something like that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember playing it and just really liking the whole presentation of it. And I really like I'm a big fan of the artwork, especially. I think you're the art director. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, I am the illustrator.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of how that. It's like almost Tool Led Zeppelin-esque is the kind of vibe I get from some of the figures or the positions, which I really like. I like the monochromatic sort of presentation of it, too. But it's one of those games that's it's easy to pick up, but hard to master.
Yes, I think that's one of those things that we really liked about how the design came together is that it seems like you're kind of going through and you're like drawing these tiles and it's like, oh, well, I don't know when I get, so how do I do this? But you play, you're like, oh, well, if I'd put that there, then I would be able to do this. But now that I haven't, I can't. So if I do it this differently next time, so you kind of start thinking through what you can do with it. And it is learnable. Most people will fail their first couple of games, but you want to have a challenging in a co-op game like this. But as people play, usually their win rate definitely increases. Usually it hovers around between like 30 and 40% is a win rate. But again, definitely it's a learnable game. And you start understanding the patterns. You start thinking like, hold on a second, I want to put this here. What if I draw a monster next? Because usually, you kind of figure out that that's going to happen. It's also a game where the more that you've drawn, the better you can predict what's going to be in the stacks. So you say, okay, I know that there's like 12 monsters in here, and we've seen 7 of them, and now there's like 30 tiles with like a 1 in 6. So you start to do some of this kind of sleuthing out of what you're going to encounter and trying to say, like, is this risk worth it or not worth it? Very learnable. It's a game that if it was just random, it wouldn't be fun, but it has a curve where you can get better at it.
Yeah, you slowly work yourself down to perfect information as you play with it. So, you know, it's like, yes, your options get more limited as your tile count lowers, but at the same time, your knowledge of what's amongst those things make it so your decisions get more and more informed, sort of collapses down on itself. I think the other thing that people, it often takes like a playthrough or so to kind of figure out is that, you know, you think of the fact that, so just to describe, because I don't think we've actually said it yet, you know, in the game, you're on a grid, you know, it's a tile laying game and you have your player pawn or token or whatever is on a tile, a piece of geography. And then you can light up any connected through a hallway, you know, tile in a one tile radius around you. Right. And that's it. That's all you can see. That's your little world that you live in. Right. And so as you move forward, you'll draw tiles to light up any new hallways that you connect. But then anything that is outside of that one tile radius goes away. And so the thing that I think takes a little bit of a learning curve, too, is for people to realize that like darkness encroaching in and erasing things is also a tool in your toolkit. And so people often are like not always thinking about the fact of like, no. If this isn't working out, if I don't like the way this is going, I can change this. I don't have to just like keep moving forward and doubling back around and wasting all this time. I can move a little here, then come back around and see if I can make it work for me.
Yeah, one of the learning curves for it is definitely like you start off, you know, it's a horror game. You feel like you're just powerless. You're just like, oh God, I have no idea what to find. This is terrible. In a good way, right? You're like, you're scared to freaking find. And as you get better at it, you're like, oh, I do have some control, but not maybe the way I thought I did. So like the good and the bad of what I lose or gain from the darkness is something I can kind of control and try and predict. So you don't get like stronger physically, right? You don't find items. You don't get abilities to fight the monster necessarily, but like your understanding of the system of the maze, the core mechanic of it is what gives you that power as you learn more about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you already have the power to make and unmake the maze. Like, you already are the most powerful thing in the maze. and simultaneously the least powerful, because you lose that power every time you use it. And another thing that we should mention for the folks who haven't actually seen it is that, you know, because this is a tile placement game, you know, you have to keep your tiles somewhere. And the way that we decided to do that is we put them into a stack that is in a tile holder that looks like a candle. And over the course of the game, because you don't get the tiles back, that candle stack diminishes. So you can have a very visible counter of how much time you have left, as well as, you know, kind of just seeing the candle run down, which is always very fun to point that out to players, like when they're about to run out.
Right.
Not going to lie, when I saw that added, because that, of course, when I played it, that wasn't a feature. You had a stack of tiles. When I saw them, like, that's such a cool idea. Like, I can literally see my doom approaching.
Obviously, you know, this game seems like one of those games where you want to play it in the dark, right? Like, your atmosphere around you really, like, kind of brings you into the game, I feel. What's like one thing that's outside of the game box that you guys might suggest to make this experience even better for the players?
Well, that's an interesting one, because technically not part of the game, but now in the game box for one of our Kickstarter tiers, this is sort of the brainchild of our publisher, Smirk and Dagger, who has brought a lot to kind of helping us realize this is a fully fleshed out thing. So the middle tier for items comes with a high quality version of the soundtrack of download, which is like a kind of like a concept EP designed to get played along with the game to enhance the atmosphere. It also comes with these tiny LED kind of votive candles. Everyone has like a status card in front of them, so you can kind of tell at a glance who's what colors and who has the keys and who's, you know, in trouble or whatever. Right. But sometimes in the game, your candle can be blown out, and there's cooperative work to try and have someone else relight your candle for you. Yeah, you may have played a much earlier version that didn't even have that part of the thing back into it. So now, if you turn the lights off, you have the soundtrack playing, and you have these, and all the lighting rooms, just these little candles in front of you. And as players, their light goes out in the game, they turn the candle off so that they're out in the dark. They're still in the dark now. That will really enhance the atmosphere. We're really excited for that game together. I'm really excited to see it, because we're still working on the soundtrack. I haven't seen the candles in person myself, because we're separated and such. Yeah, that sounds great. The other thing we've talked about is people have asked if we could do like a UV like reactive kind of thing on the tiles. Discovered was that because they're so bright to begin with, the white printing on the tiles, they're basically UV reactive anyway. So you could play the game under a black light and just see the pathways running around.
You know, if we'd raised about $200,000 more, we could have probably included a black light, but, you know, here we are.
The only other thing I'd say that would really increase the atmosphere that doesn't already come in the box is probably like an anxiety disorder. I think that would help.
Yeah, that's free. You can get those just walking down the street in 2020.
Yeah, well, you could actually.
Yeah, I don't need the stretch goal for that. I have that now.
We assume that that's included. So I'm going to say one last thing for that, too, is we had a few people have suggested that with their group, and we wouldn't recommend this because it's a cooperative game, it should be played cooperatively. But with the right group of people, this sounds really cool to us, would be that you make a rule for yourselves that you can only talk to people that you're next to in the maze. So you're trying to kind of coordinate silently with your group, and then only two of you can talk, or three of you can talk at a time next to each other. So yeah, there's lots of little things that kind of enhance that. Okay, sorry.
To be clear, we're not sure if that's going in the rule book as a recommendation, because that's not everyone's magic circle. You know,
right?
Like some that people can be a cool really variant, though.
Yeah, absolutely,
it could be.
Yeah, I think it's like a really good house rule. I'll be honest. For me personally, I think the game actually, what really makes it sing is the debate, and it is the like, right. Well, I think we should do this. Well, I don't know. Like, I think we should do this and X, Y, Z, and talking through all the permutations of possibilities of what, you know, you can face, you know, on your next like turn. Because I think the thing that's like really fascinating about the game from a design perspective. For me has been like, you know, there's the obvious part of the game that is on the board in front of you, right? But then half of the game lives in this stack, and it's about you like running through your head and figuring out like the most likely set of scenarios, and then how would you deal with each one so that you can kind of plan your, not just your turn, which you do, you know, want to kind of plan out, but then everyone else's series of turns as you kind of move around. It's not like a programming game in a formal way like that, but it creates this like kind of informal system of kind of doing that and approaching it. And then when that doesn't work out, because you can never always guess exactly right, then being flexible enough to try and figure out how to now deal with that halfway through that set of turns you were like, you know, just talking about.
Right. And also, if you're discussing and you're like, I think we should do this, and then you do that, and then we all died. Like, whoops.
That can also happen. I mean, yeah. We don't have player elimination, which is good. Now, you know, your right. candle goes out. But yes, it still feels like you died.
Right.
Like, it's like,
Well, it's actually worse than that now, I think, because, you didn't die. You just let everyone down and cost them precious, precious time and wax. And that's like, you know, that's worse.
Right. That's true. Yeah. When you get hit now, you don't just like go away and it's like, well, tough luck for Jim. It's like, no, now your candlelight goes out. When the monster hits you, it eats some of the wax of your candle. So the stack actually drops down from getting hit. Now, every time you move, lights out, you have to just blindly draw. So you could easily land on another one of those. Like, you don't know, like, kind of what's going to happen until somebody gets you relit. So you become this, like, liability. And so it really does adjust or affect the tempo of the game when that happens. And, like, you are a track. We say that this is a game of sticks without carrots. Like, that is kind of our philosophy.
So one component I didn't recognize from playing it before is I don't think when I played there was nerve tokens. What is that a new mechanic that's added or?
Relatively recently.
Yeah, was that like the end of 2019, right? Yeah.
Yeah, probably the very end. Yeah. It's probably the most recent piece of the game. And so basically, it's just another. It's a system sort of laid on top there that can allow you sort of a set of additional actions to sort of respond to what's happening in the maze. And so it's, you know, if you imagine, like, so everyone starts off with one nerve token, and then you can gain more by staying in place because, like, you don't always have to move in the maze. You can choose to stay put to keep certain things around if you want to, which still costs you time. You still have to burn a tile because time's still going by. But you can earn a nerve token. You're basically, like, building up your courage to do something, like, bigger. And so we have, like, a set of, like, actions you can kind of spend that on. Some of them are things like mitigating the amount of, like, you know, penalties you might get from a monster. You know, some of them are about, like, you know, taking extra movement, you know, if it would be advantageous for somebody to get over here faster. It gives you the flexibility to sort of do that. You know, and then there's one that deals with, like, our in-game scenario where, like, once you run out of tiles, the game doesn't end, but since you can't put any more tiles because your candle's going out, right, you move the way you normally move. Anything outside your light falls off, and then you also have to take an extra tile off as your candles are going out and the maze is sort of collapsing down around you, right? And so this you can also use nerve to sort of not have to do that additional tile removal action on your turn during the final flicker stage. So it kind of helps you manage that a little bit.
So it's another, like, strategic option, which is pretty cool. And it's symmetrical. Like, everyone can do the same actions.
Yeah. And the nerve is also nice if you're doing, like, a really important team action, like, I need to watch this gate or I need to keep this key here so that someone else can come and get it from the other side. You build up this nerve and then it's like, okay, like, I don't feel like I did as much this turn, but now I have more options on the next turn that can do more things that are more active and more engaged with the process. And we feel that that's nice. And also lets you kind of control the tempo of the game a little bit. It's like, oh, if only I was one tile closer. Well, now you can, but what is it going to cost you long term to get that closeness you want?
Very cool. I like that addition.
Yeah, it was kind of important to us to have some symmetry just because, like, we want you to kind of put yourself into the game as opposed to be like have a separation of like, oh, I'm the captain or I'm playing the, you know, this character or that character. Because since it's a horror game and we're trying to kind of create this anxiety in you, we felt that, like, the more personal, you know, the more you project yourself into your character in the game, the more raw that feeling is going to be. Versus giving you, like, a cipher to separate you from it.
Right.
It's also, I think, helped a bit with the quarterbacking issue that a lot of co-ops run into.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
In this case, not having like asymmetrical powers and everything, I think helps keep everyone's sort of general level of uncertainty high enough that that making that plan has to be more of a group discussion because we can't all, like, you know, there isn't one MVP here, you know. They might be really useful now, but, you know, one tile draw later, that might be the biggest liability to the team.
Right. If you had to pick one thing about Night Cage that you think is the best thing about Night Cage, what would it be?
I think that we got really I mean, honestly, I keep thinking of things I would, like, want to say for this, but picking one, I'm going to say... think that it's the unexpectedness of the core candlelight mechanic to it. I think that, you know, every time we show someone this in person, maybe you had the same experience seeing it, like watch people's eyes like get wide when they realize, oh, like this implies, like I thought I knew what a maze game is going to be like, but this changes everything I thought I knew about this. And all, even before I start explaining, like, and then this happened, I can see experienced gamers go like, they start thinking through the ramifications of that, and like they kind of just get really excited to get into it. So I think for me, the unexpectedness of how much that simple change adds to the game, and how much we've been able to hew to keep close to us—you're always right next to that core tension. It doesn't feel like you're stuck in other systems that don't really relate to that. You're always thinking about that core action all the time.
Yeah, I think the strength of the core candlelight mechanic is the thing that I'm most proud of with this game, because everything really hangs on it very well, like not just from a mechanical standpoint, but from a thematic one as well. And they're informed by each other. All the choices that we've made in this game have been very tightly tied to how that mechanic and the sort of things that it evokes naturally are, you know, coherent.
I'm not going to say the same thing a third time, so I'm going to say pitch-ups. which honestly, if I'm being honest, actually was the first thing I thought. Like, all of that is true, but I really like jumping in pits. So we designed the game to not have any dead ends, right? Because the best scenario in our experience, I mean, there are also design reasons, but I think that as important those are, I think they're a little secondary to the fact that, like, you can always get away from things when there are no dead ends, but it also always means you could run into some other thing. Right. There are no dead ends. And so it keeps that tension pumped up really high. And part of that is that we created certain tiles that collapse after you've kind of navigated across them, right, and into pits, which seems pretty normal, right? But usually, like, a pit trap like that, a pitfall, would be something that would kill you or injure you. And that's not the case in this game. In the same way that the board, I think this is something we haven't mentioned either, the board wraps around like Pac-Man, so there's no like edges to the maze. You just keep kind of going infinitely. In the same way that you do that on a flat plane, it's infinite on this vertical plane as well. So you can choose to fall into a pit, you know, and you'll make a decision about, you know, what row or column you want to land on, and then you come off the board, and then on your next turn, you fall right back in somewhere else on the maze. Right. And then you draw back up and then you, you know, take your move and so on and so forth. And you kind of live with whatever the repercussions are of that. And there are certain, you know, risks and rewards associated with it. It's a really fast way to get to where you want to be, you know, but you have these like much higher potential of like, you know, if you fall on a monster, there's no avoiding it. You just take the hit, you know, so you have to sort of make a more substantial risk calculation than you do with some of the other movements in the game. But I think it's like, I find it really exciting. I always like, I always feel like it's one of the most like, you know, energetic and like, you know, high tension moments whenever it's like, all right, I'm going to jump this pit. It's like, oh, shit, I guess we're going to find out what happens like around.
It's also got this really fun thing like at the beginning of the game, right, where it throws you right into the scenario, because like the tile that everyone starts on is cracked. Like everyone starts on a tile that will turn into a pit, so like you can't stay still. Like right off the bat, you've woke up, you don't even have time to like think about what you're doing before the ground beneath you starts crumbling and we're in, you know. It creates a lot of really fun stuff with the narrative arc, the way that that's built.
Stick, not carrot.
Right, yep. Exactly. Yep. I do like the pacing of the game a lot. When we were, again, this was 2.5 years ago now. I can't really remember if the wraparound rule was in effect or if that was something you guys were working on. Because when there was points where I'm like, oh, I can sort of press my back against the wall and not have something. But now that that's been removed, that's just another layer of dread that's kind of added to this. Because while playing it, I'm like, okay, this makes sense. I'm sort of learning the maze. And then it disappears behind me. I'm like, nope. No, I have no idea where I am. This is like Chris in a real maze. He's just lost.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff has changed. Like, so like things like that, like the wraparound board keeps things like continually changing in a way that like, cause also pit jumps have changed. So like you don't end up on the corners of the board in the same way anymore. Like you don't have these kinds of you're out of role or like, oh, I can make myself safe by doing this kind of actions. Another thing I think might have changed a long time ago, keys used to appear on tiles that only had one entrance. So you'd go on to them and come back out and reset. But then it would be a situation where it's like, okay, so I'd spend the whole turn getting onto the key. Nothing happens, and then the whole turn coming back off the key. And now keys are one of the most exposed kind of tiles in the game. You go onto them, you're going to draw tons of tiles, which possibly, you know, brings you new exciting things to make choices about, or puts you at risk in a way that you weren't a second ago. Lots of decisions have been made to kind of continually keep you on your toes and challenge those kind of things. Trying to think of another example of that. That
had struck the board.
Yeah, the board is smaller. I think it was 9x9 back then. Chris Chan fought tooth and nail to get it smaller, and he was right to do it, because now the 1-4 players, the board is a 6x6 grid, and one of our stretch goals was to add a 5-player variant that plays on a 7x7 grid, because 6x6 is slightly too small for that to be fun.
Slightly too small for it to have a reasonable win percentage.
I mean, you could try it. If you're feeling it, you should go for it.
By shrinking the board, it upped the amount of like light interaction between the players, which makes it a little more interesting. And it both makes it more dangerous, but also gives people more control. Because a big tension to the game is how close are we? Because the closer you are, the more at risk you are, because the way the monsters work is they're like little bombs in Bomberman. They will attack in all four directions down any connected hallway as far as they can, you know, go until they hit darkness or a corner or whatever. So vicinity to one another is a big risk, you know, but at the same time, it's also a huge benefit, right? Because if your light's overlapping, it gives you much more freedom of movement. It's like, all right, so you're covering that. So now I can go over here to like go check this out or get this or find whatever. So there's a bit of that's part of the rhythm and the strategy of the game is like working those physical relationships. And by shrinking the board down, we forced like situations where players have to engage with that tension more often.
Yeah, the risk that you pose to other players is often like the sort of core tension of the game strategically.
Right.
And like we have a couple advanced monsters that really sort of dig into that idea a lot more. Some that were before we started, you know, the Kickstarter, and then some that came out as stretch goals during the Kickstarter. And I mean, they're delightful.
Great.
I guess.
I mean, they're not.
Hey, I was going to say.
They're not.
Me have them delightful. like that thing you right. like because he's a jerk.
Right.
Yeah, pretty much. I'll talk about the first one then. So the first one that you can play, like, you know, after you've played a couple games, it's called a keeper. And these monsters, they replace all the keys on the board. Like, they have a key inside them. Think, you know, apply some more video game logic. They're like skeletons in Zelda, right? Now, you can't kill them, you know, but you can sneak up behind them because, like, they otherwise behave like the other monsters, attacking out as far as they can, provoked like those other monsters. But they have a sort of vulnerable backside, so you can sneak up behind them, and you have to work with other players to do that because it's just too inefficient to try and do it yourself. The other thing they do, unlike everything else in the maze, is they persist. So they create these nice little goalposts for people who like that style of play where it's like, okay, I see this, that, the other thing, but they're also threats at the same time, which is very... It's a fun tension to have a bunch of them come out all at once, because unlike other monsters, you can't get rid of them until you collect a key. They're delightful. The other one, I just adore this monster, and if it's not like a game that is anyone's learning game, I just put it in at this point.
I think it's everyone's favorite.
Yeah, I mean...
Like, I think it's the universal favorite monster.
It's best monster.
Yes, like, it is.
So the Pit Fiend, unlike every other monster in this game, right, where when you discover it, you get some warning about it, the Pit Fiend is more like an event. It just happens when you find it and where you place it. So, you know, you still get the choice of where you're going to put this thing, and that's very important because this guy doesn't follow the sort of orthogonal rules that everyone else has been doing so far because almost everything happens on, like, a regular sort of through-the-edges cross. This guy attacks diagonally, and the way that attacks is... he doesn't actually hurt you. He just turns the tiles that are diagonal to him in all directions, regardless of, like, you know, whether it's dark, light, whatever, into pits. And, like, the result of this is that you can lose keys, gates, you can toss other players into pits. And more importantly, when you discover this guy, because of the nature of a diagonal attack, it never hits you. It only screws the other players.
Oh,
and it's
right.
Amazing. Yeah. It's oh. It's the worst.
I have two questions. First of all, is the Pit Fiend an Easter egg for Roswell, who said he loved pits? Is that where the Pit Fiend comes from?
It did evolve from our general love of
pits.
Think we all like the
pits. We're all pit fiends.
We're all pit fiends. I will say that Ross the pit is definitely his baby. Like, he's pushed that idea the farthest thing about Bentley.
Does the Pit Fiend resemble Roswell? That's the real question.
Is it just like his face on a tile?
It has hollow sunken eyes like me, yes.
Am I understanding that the monsters are sort of modular now, that you can pick and choose, or are they all just present at all times?
So we usually
can describe
it.
The candle?
Yes, so we basically describe it in a couple of ways, and we're still refining how we want to describe all these pieces, but the base game is the default monster, which we call Wax Eaters. They attack orthogonally. They have rules that follow the way the maze. They kind of reinforce the mechanics of how the maze functions as part of their the way they move, or the way they attack, rather. And they also threaten core. The light from your candle is the most important thing they threaten. Other ones sort of are designed to intentionally change how you think about the space. So the pit fiends make you aware of diagonals and how you're positioned, how you're going to move. The keepers make you aware of how you're positioned around them, so try and coordinate. So, like, okay, if I'm here, you can get around here, and I'll go to this monster. You have that kind of awareness of each other in a new way. We added two new things from our
stretch goals.
Yep. We added the Pathless, and that's basically like a boss version of the Wax Eater, but it ignores all those barriers. All it wants to do is just hit you for, like, tons of extra wax in these kind of spaces. You have to be very aware of how you're going to coordinate around that. It violates some of those rules. And then the last thing we added, our kind of finale stretch goal, was a creature called the Dirge, which is preceded by these omens, and they're kind of actually like a countdown. You draw them out, and you know after you see two of these, we're going to place this creature that takes up 9 tiles. So it violates all of the rules that everything only lives on one space at a time. You can kind of know the scale of it. It violates all the scale of the game, its appearance. So the answer is yes. You would never play with all of those. It's too many to have in one thing. You're going to just lose immediately.
It's still one will, but yeah,
will,
they won't have a good.
And God bless them, but the idea is that, like, okay, like, we feel like get this, and I mean, I'll say, we were talking today, we've probably each played this a couple hundred times at this point. Wow. I think we counted our estimate between the three of us and our publisher, we probably I think we just pulled out of thin air the number, like, 1,200 games, something like that, collectively.
That was the low-end estimate, was 1,200 games.
Wow.
And I don't find it boring or predictable at all. I really don't. It's a game that, like, you can get better at, and you can see patterns and get things, but, like, it's never a game that feels like, I got it, just play it autopilot. It's never a game where you're just like, I know that's going to happen. There's always tense moments, there's always unpredictability, and there's always things where I look at it and it's like, I don't know. Let's see what happens. It's always surprising in that case. But if you have people who you want to show them, you want to add new dimensions to it, or you want to add some flavor to it so that it keeps it kind of interesting for you, we have all these pieces that kind of give you that kind of longevity for the game. Because we want it to be a game that feels like it offers you value, right? Like, I think all of us have bought at some point, like, a game that seemed like a really cool idea, and you played it like 2 or 3 times, and you're like, that was cool. I feel like I got kind of all of the thing that is in this game out of that.
Yeah,
And we wanted to make sure that we had a game that felt like if you put your time and attention and money and space into it, you got rewarded for that continuously. It didn't feel like a thing that you had to, like, have just the right people to play it with, or you needed to find 4 hours, or you needed to, you know, it was a game that you could kind of come back to regularly, and it would feel like a staple rather than just sort of like a really cool idea that you wish you could do more with.
Yeah, and to add on to that, the other thing that after all these plays, the game does not feel like to me. Is Candyland, because, like, I know that sounds like a joke, but it's actually not. Because one of the critiques that we've occasionally gotten from, like, I think more sort of like Euro optimization style gamers is that, like, you know, this game feels like it has a high degree of randomness. Well, yes, it has a high degree of uncertainty, but it's actually a very knowable game in the way that a deck of cards is knowable, right? Like, and it's about understanding what your probabilities are as you play through the game. And it's going to create unique scenarios very frequently, you know, and stuff comes up, like, every now and again still that's like, whoa, that is a completely novel thing that I haven't dealt with. But it's also something that I might have some precedent for. So it's like, okay, I know that the monsters came out early. So my main goal with this game is going to be making sure that we stay organized, don't do dumb things, right?
Right.
Or, you know, worse, the monsters have not come out at all. When is it going to happen? You know, That's my favorite type of game
when everyone's playing. It's like, wow, we got like half the keys. We got a gate. This is going awesome. And I'm just like,
it's not going awesome.
It's going awesome right now.
This is actually the hardest version of the game that you're playing then, right now.
That's, that's when Chris Chan says, oh, watch out. It's about to get delightful.
No, it's like, and it always is showing us like new stuff. Like we did, like we just did a bunch of demoing on for Gen Con Online. We played just a shit ton of games. When I say we, I mean these two, because I only play a handful of them because I just had back surgery and I can't sit for very long. But anyway, we played a ton of games with people. And I mean, we were seeing stuff that like, I mean, I had this one game that I literally in the middle of the game had to share a screen grab on Discord with everyone else running the con to be like, I cannot believe what these people just did. This is the craziest setup I've ever seen. And I had to then explain to everyone how they even did it, because it wasn't like, it looked like an impossible to create situation.
I looked at it like, how you did this.
Like, it is not possible like, for not you possible to have these scenario. Things that upset each other. Yeah, they like surrounded themselves with monsters in this weird way. And it was just because was, like, of
eight
like,
monsters on the field at the one time. It should have been literally impossible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was because like a lights out mechanic and a pitch up mechanic interacted in this really unique way. And it created this really crazy scenario. But the best part and my favorite part about that is like a thing that like we'd never seen and like that just looked like a total like loss when you just looked at it. Is that they managed to get out of it. Every single, they have, I think, four players. It might have been five. I can't remember if it was four or five. Every single one of them was threatened by a monster the way this ship went down. And they managed to get out of it with one person getting hit, and that's it. And that's what we mean when we're saying, like, the game can feel like, it, when you just kind of glance at it, like it's this, like, RNG fest or something. But it's actually, there's a lot of strategy that you can employ to take control over what's happening with you once you understand what's happening with those mechanics and how they overlap and interact, you know, and what your levers are. The levers are just a little less obvious than like, you know, I buy this in this market, or we kind of use different ones than I think what people are used to seeing. I think that's part of a big part of what it is.
Gotcha. Very cool. So for Gen Con online, did you use your upcoming tabletop simulator proto, or did you have I'm very excited about.
Yeah. It's not the one you can find on there right now.
No, that one. I love that one though. I gotta say, I love that fan made one though. It's very flattering, and B, like it is all the choices that we like went through our head at one point, and we're like, you know what? No, that feels like a vampire game. You know, or something, you know, like it's one of those things where it's like, we know what this game is, you know? And like with horror games, it's so easy to, you know, just jump to trope because, you know, it's fun, but
right.
This is a game that has a very specific point of view on the type of horror that you are in. You know, it's also the sort of game where that like you are creating your own horror. You know, like this is a maze that only exists because you're seeing it. All the things that are bad exist in the places they do when they do because you observed them and you chose to look that way. And there it is. I really appreciate seeing, you know, someone else's take on that. Like it's fun. You know,
it's my favorite Vampire the Masquerade module. On
there are so many candles. Where did they even get all those candle bottles?
Candles, the smoke effects. It's really delightful. But
it's for great. Our TTS, it's really flattering.
Yeah. TTS build, though, is one of our stretch goals. It's that everyone who backed the campaign and is getting a copy of the game is also going to get, I'm hoping, in the next couple of weeks here. We're still updating some pieces to it to include some of the stretch goals that we added to the campaign as well. But yeah, that's something we're going to put in now so that everyone will have access to that. I think we're looking at trying to add some other things as well. We've been discussing internally what it might be like to add like a Tabletopia variant. But yeah, like digital accessibility is big, especially if people are going to be waiting until early next year to get their copies. So we want to have a way to play, you know, and hang out, especially if you can't see people, you know, to have a way to do that.
Exactly.
So on the day that we released that particular stretch goal, like I think that was the second most commented day, like aside from the day that we dropped like the Infinite Darkness pledge. Because people were so, like, had
it's
such
very polarizing.
Different reactions to that one. Because some people were like, this is amazing, great. Other people were like, but I want more things. I want more things, and I want them now. I have the things. Right. I know this is a thing, but it's not the thing I wanted. And in particular, I didn't want this thing. I'm going to play it, but I don't like it.
It's interesting. It's interesting because, like, I was surprised because, you know, we've been using TTS as a digital development tool for a while. Like, our build was not as polished as this for a long time. But, like, been using it because we're remote or because we just can't all get to the same place to play. So it's been an important part of our development process for a while. But in our mind, it felt very natural that, you know, especially with people not being able to go in person to see people often, like TTS and Tabletopia were going to become a bigger part of the learning community. And I think we were really surprised at how many people didn't see it that way. Like, they just were totally outside of that space of making that digital transition. I think a lot of us have kind of accepted as sort of, at least for the short time, like a critical part of the hobby now. And so it was kind of eye-opening to see people who had not really seen it that way and who were very set on staying with the physical thing, which is great. It's a physical hobby, but, like, you know, we're making adjustments to it. When we first started doing testing like this, our publisher, Kurt, he's been publishing board games for like 17 years. He's just like, he's a classic pro. He's done this for a long, long time, but he'd never gotten to the digital side of it. So we had to kind of walk him through like what this is and how to set it up. In our first games, he was just like, I hate this. Like, I want to have the physical thing. Like, he was dead set against it. And of course, he's a smart guy. He picked it up very, very quickly, but like, and he sees the benefits of it for sure. But it was just funny because, again, like, there's definitely, you know, a huge part of the gaming community, board game community, that has not, that does not want to make that transition, or is sort of confused at how to make that transition to digital spaces for the hobby.
Yeah, Kurt definitely spends more time at TTS than the rest of us now, which is the most ironic part of it. He's just been there constantly.
I think he's integrating a lot into developing other games and working on the design work stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we take for granted the familiarity people have with it sometimes, because as game developers, it has this really powerful, you know, benefit for us beyond just the obvious, like, oh, I can play a board game whenever. But it's like, yeah, and that's cool, but, like, you know, board games aren't necessarily the most important thing you're doing. If it's more just like a thing I play with friends, this and the other, maybe that's not a challenge I feel in the same way. But like, when you're trying to make something, you know, and like, you can't get schedules to line up, it's really powerful. And so I think sometimes we just assume more people are kind of tuned into it. Although I think a lot of people, I think this pandemic has changed that. And I think people are definitely like getting into it much deeper, which is great.
So, I mean, that said, like, this is also part of why we're talking about Tabletopia as well, because, you know, as Chris said, digital accessibility is huge. And, you know, Tabletopia, while, you know, if you were to play a bunch of games on it, would not be cheaper than Tabletop Simulator, has a cheaper barrier to entry for our game. So it's something that would be that's very important to us. And, you know, I don't know exactly what's going to happen with it, but it's something that is that's being looked into very seriously.
Yeah, I think this whole situation has changed a lot of our points of view. Stephen can attest to mine. I kind of have this curmudgeon business where I'm like, Stephen, where's the power button? How do you turn it on? And I show on a TTS for the first time. I'm like, all right, Stephen, how do you flip the table? That's why I'm here.
That's Chris's goal.
There's a button
everything.
For it.
I know, but apparently I'm not strong enough. Somehow Stephen has zapped my strength. So I'm frustrating here, like, trying to lift a table for hours. I'm like, Stephen rolled an 18. Well, that should be enough.
He might have disabled the flip option.
I think he just disabled my fun options.
Don't give away my secrets, okay?
I'll never find him, Steven. You should be happy I've turned on the computer today.
Yeah, you're right. So guys, are you guys going to do a late pledge? Are you guys just doing a pre-order system? How are you guys doing kind of people who want to get the game or at least support you guys while they're waiting for the game to come out next year?
Yeah, we have a pledge manager. I think it's going to be up, guys. It's like early next week, right? I think that's what Kurt said. So it's not quite live yet. So if you go to the page, it won't take you there yet.
Okay.
It takes a couple of days to kind of get it worked out. But I think early next week, certainly by middle of next week, it'll be ready to go. And we're going to be taking late pledges, I think, right up until, you know, the button gets pressed on the Heidelberg Press. Like, you know.
You ready? You sure? Yeah. Okay, go.
Yeah, I think it's at least several weeks. Yeah,
okay. Be doing that. Well, by the time this comes out on the air in the interwebs, see, I know how things work, Stephen. we'll have the link there, and perhaps at this point, that button will be pressable.
Yeah,
I think hopefully, in a dream, someone with a bird wished for me the 12th, but don't hold me to that number or date. Because again, a bird wished for me a dream, so we'll see.
How about this? I'm gonna open up Kurt's last update, and I'm going to read it real quick.
Okay, great.
Okay. Can you read it in a voice?
Yeah,
what does he sound like?
Do that. Kurt?
Kurt does not sound like the singer.
Funny voice.
Oh, boo.
He doesn't, but I'm going to have you pretend he's the singer for the B-52s.
Oh, Rock Lobster.
That's doable. Yeah, Chan, you can't really back out of that.
I don't... I don't know if I can do that. Like, I don't know if I can do that.
We need to do like background music for you, like.
It wasn't a pit. It was a wax beater.
All right.
See?
No, I don't. No,
you were a theater major. Come on.
No, I. Here's why I can't do it. Because I can't remember what the lead singer sounds like. I'm having one of those moments.
So
So I can read it for you in the voice of that I use for my cat. When I'm being
that's
terrible. That's
okay. I'm interested in this experience.
Okay.
That sounds delightful.
I'm going to regret
this. Mute real quick while I'm doing this. That was mine. No mind. Yep.
Yeah.
Now comes the hard work of making the night cage real. Our pledge manager will be open next week from the 12th. You can make changes to your pledge and manage and add-ons and shipping, etc. We will probably hold that open for a good 3 weeks as we get final quotations and prepare final art for production. Now die in a fire and give me dinner.
So that sounded like a mixture of Garfield with a 90-year-old woman with emphysema.
I like it. I was going to ask how many hit points the goblin has.
Yeah.
All right. Yep.
That was fantastic.
Yes.
That's great. Thank you
for that. So sometime on the around the 12th.
Yes. Sometime around the 12th.
Yeah.
Yes. You heard it here from my cat.
we'll have to do a playthrough. That sounds fun.
Bree.
I heard you making fun of me. I'm not coming to get on camera now.
I mean, honestly, when I make that voice, it is because I'm making fun of her, mostly because she's getting impatient for dinner. So she kind of associates it with dinner. So here she is, waiting for dinner.
Aww. What a cute cat.
Like and subscribe for more cats.
Please do.
Why is everyone we have on here has cats, dude? We just need cats.
Yeah, we don't have cats. That's what it is. That's our peanut butter and cats. That's all you need for 2020.
Peanut butter and cats. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, McMahon and I both have cats too.
They're around somewhere.
And are on a different floor, so I'm not.
Yeah, so we're just out of the loop here, Chris. We need cats, apparently.
We need cats. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what it is. Mm-hmm.
You convince your wife, and then I'll convince mine.
I actually don't like cat. Well, I don't like owning the cat. I don't like cleaning up after the cat, so right. I will. I've had cats.
I'm with you.
No one likes cleaning up after the cat.
Mm-mm. My dog goes outside, and I go outside. Why can't the cat go outside? I don't go outside. I do have that ability.
It's a choice.
Well, thanks you guys so much for spending time with me. It is. You know, I got to get outside sometimes. With that, thank you guys so much for spending time with us and sharing a couple of brews and the story of how the Night Cage came to be. Very excited to check it out on Tabletop Simulator around the 12th-ish. Any parting words? Not that we're expecting anything bad to happen, but just
not that we expect you to fall into a pit.
What have you heard?
I'll say.
I don't know, but it's delightful.
I'll say that I'm constantly in awe of the reaction that this Kickstarter got. We expected, we had a few hundred people who were interested, like on email lists that we started, and it's just exploded to way bigger than we ever could have predicted. Like no one that we're going to have this kind of response from the start for this. So everyone who backed us, we really appreciate it, seriously. We're blown away by your support, and we know we're going to bring you something really cool. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Cool, guys.
Yeah, just that. That's enough.
Just that. Just echo that. Just
that.
Just, yeah. Mm-hmm. Chris, when you do this in post, just take that and copy it 3 times.
put me in all the windows. Yeah. Or do a deep fake of me deep through fake? All of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Copy.
That's awesome.
Copy the goblin cat voice.
I really want to see a deepfake of you voice. On
my face, Chris. Oh, God.
I don't want to see that.
If I had the skills, I would take your beard off and just superimpose a beard on all the rest of us.
That'd be great. That.
I have some of the rare pictures of Chris without a beard, and let me tell you, it's weird.
The thing could not possibly exist in this universe.
Yeah, he actually doesn't have any more face under there.
Just beard all the way down.
It just ends.
Beard. You think you'd stop finding it, but it just keeps finding more.
Chris, you are not Lion from Steven Universe.
When I shave my beard, I look like I'm 14, and my wife doesn't like it. Let's put it that way.
I mean, that's fair. That's a good sign. That's a good sign that she doesn't like you being a 14-year-old.
Exactly.
That's true. I'd never thought of it that way, but now I'll only think of it that way.
Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
Oh, God.
The Night Cage, we bring you horror.
Oh, God.
Are you feeling uneasy? That's good.
Is that the next monster? Is the endless beard?
Yes. The infinity beard.
The, at least that, in the
that
same
is the Night Cage. That's actually where the Night Cage is located. You just, you wake up. Everyone. You don't know who you are. You're cold. Your body's cold, and you're inside Chris's beard.
The walls are rustled.
That's what it is. Why is it full of monsters?
Every once in a while, little trails of smoke just come out of it.
I imagine whenever he unlocks his door, he just pulls a key out of his beard.
Keep your house keys in your beard, Chris. Chris, you could absolutely keep your house keys in your beard.
You could.
You realize that, like, you have to store tokens in there now.
That's amazing.
One day I'll achieve that beard. But it is not this day.
I know my physical limitations. I will never accomplish that. Anyway, regardless of which, thanks everyone for watching. We appreciate it very much. Thank you very much to all the team members of The Night Cage. Be sure to check it out on our podcast links, which will be attached, as well as on Tabletop Simulator in the near future.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Table Hops Podcast. Be sure to visit us at tablehopspodcast.com. Leave us an iTunes review. Or visit us on social media at Tablehop Podcast.
Be sure to check out our videos on YouTube and email us your feedback and questions to tablehopspodcast@gmail.com.
And remember,
good beers,
good games,
great times!